This is age-related, so I can cover what's important, so I have a few notes. So, good evening, everybody. My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
First of all, I'd like to thank Steve and this group for inviting us from Magnolia Brown Bag to speak. And I'm going to cover pretty much what we usually cover in speakers' meetings. There'll be a couple references to some personal trauma, which some speakers don't like to talk about. I do because it was part of my growth, and it is part of my growth. So you'll hear a couple things that are a little bit sad. I try not to get morose over them. One was taken care of with amends, and the other one was taken care of just recently. So just bear with me. Once again, my name is Jim Schloss. My sobriety date is December 20th, 2009. And this is the first math quiz for you all. My home group, before we get started, is Westminster on Godwin Boulevard. We meet on Tuesday nights. It's a literature meeting, and we do the daily reflections. I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, so that's the first apology or amends I'm going to make down here in Virginia. But I've been here quite a while, so my wife and I really loved Virginia, and it's been good to us, and we hope we've been good to it. I was born April 29th, 1946, so your first math quiz is, holy God, is this guy old? I am. And how I got to this point in time, being 76, close to 77, is a miracle. My family was maybe middle class to upper middle class. Parents were fairly normal, high achievers. I had two older brothers, 4 years older than I and 2 years older than I. And then came along myself, and if you know anything about family structure, the youngest is a little bit peculiar. And I lived that out. I was raised Jewish, still am Jewish. I'm proud to be Jewish. And the census of Jewish members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Suffolk, Virginia is zero except for me. That used to bother me. But it doesn't anymore because I understand my God and the one God concept. And so it's all the same. And then for alcohol in the family, my mom was an alcoholic. Nobody else in the family drank. And with a lot of families, we just didn't talk about it. And she'd go on weekend benders and go shopping with her girlfriends, come home completely drunk, sleep it off. Monday morning, she was up and ready to go, ran the family, took care of the kids, and ready to go. So what it was like, and so being at the age that I am, I'm going to go through a little bit of a few decades of history, but I'm going to get to why I'm still standing here and why Alcoholics Anonymous is so important to me. As a child all the way through high school, I think I was born afraid, stayed afraid, never knew that I fit into anything. It had nothing to do, I believe, with the way my parents treated me. I think they were very fair, never took a hand to any of us. But there was something in my mind that said, I'm just not good enough. I was fearful to the point where I would not cross cross the street when I ran into somebody that I knew. I always kind of sat in the back of the class, assumed I wasn't a very good student, and I was just fear-based, and it went on for probably the first 18 years of my life. The family had unspoken standards of excellence. Both of my parents were lawyers. My father didn't practice law, but he was a lawyer by education. My mom practiced law. And as it turns out, for my brothers, my oldest brother graduated with honors in high school and college. My middle brother was a Mensa, qualified for Mensa. And then there came me. And something in my mind said, I'll never be good enough. And I went like that for a long period of time in my life. The liabilities, and I'll talk about liabilities and assets because it's a big part of my recovery and it's a big part of my life today and taking inventory at the end of the day. It was fear, resentment, envy, jealousy. It was everything on the liability side of an inventory sheet that I keep. And I just couldn't get out of that crack. And it was hard. And once again, I said, I don't think it was anything my parents did or my brothers did. They were just really smart and really talented, and I just didn't have anything going for me. So I think the only niche that I could find was sports. And so I played baseball, played football, played basketball. Very white, very small, couldn't jump. And it just got to be, that's what I did. I was always, if there was a ball involved, I'd play it. And I got pretty good at it. Then I got too small for basketball and too small for football and ran into the game of golf, which I still play. And there's more about golf later. And swam a little bit in high school. And that's where I found somewhat of an identity. And during this whole time in the family structure, all the way from up until 18, alcohol was not part of our family except my mom. There was no alcohol in the house. She went out to get her drinks and stuff like that. So no alcohol in my life all the way through high school. And there were some in the program who started drinking at 6, 7, 8, 9. That was not me. I was a late bloomer in the world of alcohol. I worked in the family business. It was one of those families, you go to work at 14, you can go find your own job or your dad will find it for you. And so he found one for me, and my first job was mucking pens in stockyards in Cincinnati, Ohio. And our family was in the food business. And I started out at the very, very bottom. And a lot of stories about that too, but it proved to be a blessing, like a lot of things in my life that I didn't know at the beginning, but it is now, that I learned the business from the ground up, literally. God and religion were mandated. We went to services, we went for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, all the high holidays. Sometimes we go to Sabbath services. I got confirmed, didn't get bar mitzvahed. But it was kind of like, well, go for the high holidays, go to religious school, go to Sunday school, and that's good enough for us. So that's what I did. About that time when I was in high school, something clicked in my head. I don't know where some of these things come from, but I got the fixation and then the obsession to chase after my dad's success. He was president of the family-owned business. He had a big profile in the community. I assumed he made a lot of money, and so I wanted to be like Dad. And that sickness, after a while, became pretty toxic, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. So Jim goes off to college. I talked about golf. I was good enough, so I got a full ride to the University of Cincinnati. My identity became golf and being a screw-up. That was my identity. Got through college, 3 years. Back then you couldn't play as a freshman. And so had a good time there. Still, alcohol was not part of my life because I was on scholarship and that was an automatic dismissal if you got found drinking and carousing around. So golf was pretty much what I did when I was in college. But in addition to golf, I got involved in fraternity life. And those of you who got in fraternities or went to college back in the 60s, that was pretty sweet. And I didn't unknowingly, because I was on a full ride, people thought I was a little bit more than I was. Wanted to hang around with me because I'm on full scholarship. I'm living in the dorm with a bunch of jocks. And fraternity life on Friday and Saturday nights was pretty sweet. If we weren't playing in a golf tournament out of town, I was in the middle of that fraternity party. And somehow, some way, I started to drink. And I got more handsome, more fun to be with, a hell of a lot better dancer, and a hell of a lot more entertaining. And albeit I was probably one of the dorkiest looking kids you've ever seen in your entire life, I was all of about 5'9", weighed about 160 pounds, but I was a stud, I think. So the fraternity parties and all that, and part of my DNA until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was, excuse the language, but I was a big proponent of the screw it syndrome. If I didn't want to do something, I would just say the hell with it. And I would make up my mind that either because of my greatness or I just didn't feel like I had to do anything, I just said, I'm not going to do it. So I took the gift of a 3-year scholarship, a full ride to the University of Cincinnati, played my last match and quit school. That's the way I ran my life for quite a while. Thank God for the 12 steps. Thank God for making amends. Thank God for a lot of things in this program. I am now comfortable with some of the things I did at a younger age. But that was the beginning of Jim Screwitt syndrome. I was a sweeper. If there was a problem or something like that, I'd sweep it into the corner and hope that it would go away. That doesn't work very well. And it didn't work for me for a long period of time. So I'll go through the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Well, we're going to be here until about 10 o'clock, so just button up. But part of the job that I had when I was, after I got out of the plant operations, which I did for all 6 years, I had some glorious jobs working on slaughter floors. I worked, you know, pens, worked in the stockyards. Warren had to do a lot of stuff in the food business, in the meat business. Walt was in the same business. It is not glamorous. And it is a very, very tough business to be profitable in and a very tough business to run. But I got involved right out of college in taking in sales routes for summer vacations. And for somebody who was afraid of everything in the world, I don't know what happened, but something happened to me that said, I really like this and I think I'm pretty good at it. And so I went into sales at the company in Cincinnati and stayed in sales. And that was my career. And it crossed three different companies in three different towns. And I got good at it. And what made me feel good about it was that I felt like I belonged. The customers liked me. The company liked me because my numbers were extraordinary for some unexplainable reason. I didn't know how I got good at what I was doing. This sounds a little self-serving, but I was good. And so sales became my passion. And I did pretty good at the company that I worked at in Cincinnati. In addition to that, what was really good is people recognized me. I had now spent 22 years or 23 years of my life hiding in the corner, not crossing the street, not engaging with anybody, and now I'm sitting there being recognized for my achievements in sales. And this became almost like my first taste of feeling different. You probably know what's coming next with the world of sales. Then came money. Then I became even more sure that I was better than everybody else. And here comes alcohol. I started drinking when I was 23 years old, and I remember it like it was yesterday. I had no reason to drink before that. And so as I started to get different sales assignments, the customers would want to go to the bar after the workday. Those of us in the food business, the workday ended about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which, you know, that was nice. So we'd hit the bars about 3, drink until 7 or 8. If there was an opportunity in the spring, summer, or fall, we'd play golf. And people liked to play golf with me because they knew I'd run through college on a scholarship. And so the combination of business and golf started my going out and my first excitement and my first consumption of alcohol. I really wasn't, I would call myself for a long period of time a social drinker, which is a crock too, but I was a social drinker, enjoyed it, but the combination of being good at my business, being good on the golf course, and being recognized by my customers gave me a shot of adrenaline every frigging day to make me feel like I was better than I really was. And I started to develop some really bad habits. And those are also on the liability side of the ledger. So in my 20s, on a personal relationship side, this person who can't be really denied because he's so wonderful at everything, I got married at 22. I was so socially immature at the time, you couldn't even register it. So I got married at 22, had my first child with my first wife, 24, and I got divorced at 30. Now you'll figure this out pretty soon, that my idea of personal relationships, there were no fences. I had not one boundary. So I got divorced, stayed single for a year and a half, got married again at 33 to my second wife, had a daughter at 37, and amazingly enough, Jim was divorced at 42. I've got three kids, two marriages, I'm 42 years old, and I am on a roll with alcohol. I didn't understand what it is to be a responsible father. I didn't understand what it was to be a responsible husband. And I didn't understand the effects of the alcohol were starting to take over on my life. It was pretty chaotic. So, no boundaries, ego consumed, defined by money and recognition, and this alcoholic was off and running. Now alcohol was becoming a necessity. So in the short period of time, in 20 years, I was from my first drink, I now couldn't do without it. I woke up in the morning, I needed it. During the work day, I needed it. During the night, I needed it. And I needed it when I went on vacations. I needed it all the time. I still didn't understand what alcoholism was. I didn't want to be like my mother. I didn't want to be labeled an alcoholic. I don't even think I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous ever until I was well into my 50s. So 40s come, I'm married for the third time, I'm 44 years old, and my business career and my success in business have absolutely skyrocketed. Now this is gonna sound kind of egotistical, but it's not. I'm just saying that I was consumed with trying to get better at my craft, selling anybody and everybody that I could. I had a knack to figure out compensation systems faster than anybody that I knew. And they were all based with companies, thankfully, that had a base salary, which was fair. But bonus systems you could figure out immediately. And there were no caps. I had the opportunity to work for three different companies, and there was no cap to the bonus system. So this maniac figured out the caps, figured out the compensation system, and I was off and running. So now I'm really good at my trade. There's no cap. I can make as much money as possible. And I now have alcohol by my side. I'm better looking. I'm smarter. I'm more successful. I'm richer. And I am going to run over you like a friggin' tractor. That's what I was. Today I understand what I was. Back then, that's just what I wanted to be. In the quest to be my dad, I was catching up to him, both in compensation and entitled. And that still consumed me. So I went down that highway for a long period of time. It was always, in the program they teach us less is more. My mantra was more is more. There was never an off switch. I couldn't make enough money. I couldn't have a bigger, I needed to have a bigger title. I needed to have more people report to me. And alcohol was everywhere. Every day I consumed something. Now, to tell you how sick I was, I thought it was funny at the time. I had some class when I was drinking a lot. I had the 50-degree rule. It was lower than 50 degrees outside, I'd drink scotch. It was higher than 50 degrees, I'd drink vodka. So I was a pretty refined alcoholic, but I didn't know it. But I did not, from the day I started drinking to the day I stopped drinking, I never put anything in that drink except alcohol. I didn't use tonic, I didn't use soda, I didn't use any fruit drinks. It was just, give me a scotch on the rocks, give me vodka on the rocks. And at one point in time, I just finally graduated to martinis. And as we all do, I finally graduated to just binge drinking. So alcohol was part of me most every day. And the cunning, baffling, and powerful that I know now had absolutely taken a grip on this alcoholic, and I was tied up. I could not function without alcohol. Don't remember many blackouts, but there were a number of times where I went to work drunk, stayed drunk, got more drunk as the day went on, but somehow, some way, in the companies that I worked for, if they knew I was drinking, they probably did, I put such numbers on the board, and the people who worked with me helped me make those numbers, that nobody said anything. Just go out and do what you're supposed to do. Jump on an airplane, go here, go there, do whatever you're doing. I'd leave home on Monday, come home on Friday. Most Friday nights I came home, I was drunk. Stay the weekend. Sarah would say, you really might want to watch what you're drinking. Paid no attention to that. Alcohol abuse was here for this alcoholic. So I'll give you a couple of dates that are burned into my memory, and I only do that to emphasize the fact how alcohol can absolutely completely destroy somebody's life. On August 2nd, 2002, Sarah and I were out at the beach having dinner. She was vibrant, beautiful, having a good time. Both of us drank too much. And coming home from Virginia Beach, we made it all the way to 100 yards from the entrance of our home. I drove off the road. The report was that it was reckless driving. I told everybody I fell asleep at the wheel. The truth was my alcohol level was so far above the level of sober that it was ridiculous. Sarah went out the top of the car. I went out the side of the car. Sarah was Nightingale to the Sentara Norfolk General. I was in the life squad in Sentara Norfolk General. And because of concussions and my injuries, I couldn't go see Sarah for 4 days. Didn't know what was going on. Wasn't allowed to get out of my room. And on the fourth day, they came and got me and said, "You gotta go see your wife." So I walked down the hall and I'll be all right. And the doctor said, "Come sit down. I want to talk to the two of you. And you may not understand what I'm about ready to tell you, but your wife will never walk again. She's a T12 complete paraplegic. And Jim, you'll recover from your injuries. It'll take you a while. But your wife will be confined to the wheelchair for the rest of her life." I knew that I was dead drunk when I wrecked that car. The good news is that they brought Sarah back 3 times. She flatlined 3 times. So we started our journey as, I started my journey as caregiver and husband to, I described it, and this is a horrible thing to say, but I can say it now. I was a caregiver for wife. All that wonderful life that I had, that Sarah had, was destroyed by alcohol. It was destroyed by carelessness. It was destroyed by ego. It was destroyed by self-centeredness. It was destroyed by everything that I, today, I've made amends for. Everybody tells me it was an accident. I know better, but I'm comfortable with the situation now. Because as alcohol is a disease, I was a sick human being. I was afflicted with a terrible, terrible disease. So she goes to rehab in Atlanta. I join her after 3 weeks because I can't travel because of blood clots and a grade A concussion and some other stuff. And she fights through rehab for 4 months at the Shepherd Center, and I went down to join her because you can't get out of Shepherd Center and come back home unless you have somebody as a spouse or something to give you to be your caregiver. So we started on that journey. I stopped drinking for 6 months. My wife is confined to a wheelchair. And my mind was so screwed up by alcohol, and so screwed up by ego, and so screwed up by self-centeredness, among some other character defects. I couldn't see my way clear to stop drinking. This is 2003. If you paid attention, my sobriety date is December 20th of 2009. There's a gap in there, people. 6 friggin' years. I continued to drink. She was in my care. We had paid caregivers, but she was in my care. So I tell people now that I was married to probably the bravest, nicest, most beautiful creature that I've ever met. And I believe that. She had more dignity about her issue than anybody I've ever met. She made a life for herself. She would get in her wheelchair, go down the ramp at our house, go across the fairway of the golf course we live on, and join her girlfriends, and she would take that wheelchair and follow them for 18 holes. She fell out of it a couple times, didn't care. Broke a couple legs, didn't care. But she had more life in her for somebody with a disability than I had with somebody without a disability. So we come home from the Shepherd Center, go backwards a little bit. We're home 4 days, Doctor calls, I'm not home, of course. I need to talk to Jim. Sarah said, whatever you can talk to Jim about, you can talk to me about. That's the way she ran things. She said, well, we really need to talk to Jim. And she said, I'm going to tell you one more time, whatever you need to talk to Jim about, you're going to talk to me about. Your husband's got cancer. There's still no God in my life. If there was, I would have one of my conversations with him I have now. So I had stage 2 prostate cancer, which if you know anything about cancer, cancer's cancer, but prostate cancer moves a little slower, and you can do some things and get some help quicker, or get some help in time so you don't just die. If you don't do anything with it, which was my MO, it immediately goes to your spine and you die. So my brother, who was the doctor, told me, you need to make sure you pay attention to this and get some help. So Johns Hopkins now has my prostate gland. So that happened, and then I just went on with my life. Came home, threw money at caregivers, took care of Sarah the best I could for an alcoholic. And time went on until 2009. She begged me to stop drinking. She wrote letters to me to stop drinking. She did everything she could to help me stop drinking. And I did everything that us alcoholics do. I dropped back to beer, then I dropped back to wine, and I dropped back to putting tonic in vodka, which made me half sick. It was ridiculous. That's how low this alcoholic got. And I will get to the point of when I got into the program real quick here. December 20th, 2009 is my sobriety date. For the month leading up to that date, I drank a fifth every day. If I could get it more, I'd drink 2 fifths. Most every night I was completely drunk and I started to black out. My wife is there, still paralyzed for life, and I'm drinking myself into oblivion. So in the morning of 2009, she reaches over to me and she thinks I'm dead. I was close. Called the life squad, the life squad comes and said, Mrs. Schloss, your husband's got alcoholic poisoning, and if he drinks again, he's going to die right in front of you. He's got to stop right now. We've got to take him to the hospital for a few days, get him cleaned up, and we'll bring him back as fast as we can because I know you need him. This is the lady that I had resentment about. I had resentment towards Sarah because she was in a wheelchair, and she was taking away my life. I had to be there for her, and I couldn't travel. I couldn't play golf as much as I wanted. I couldn't do what I really wanted to do. And I started to have a resentment towards my wife, who had nothing to do with this because alcohol had taken over my life. So she calls the life squad. I go to Merritt View. They bring me back. She calls my kids. They flew in. And she said, I have an addiction physician for you, Dr. Michael Bohan. Some of you may know him. And you're going to go see him next Monday. And you're going to start getting into this program, and we're going to send you to rehab. I don't think you are. Oh, we're sending you to rehab. So I went to see Dr. Bohan, and I don't know if you've ever taken the quiz. Probably most of you have. It's a 7-question quiz. Are you an alcoholic is the end result. It was the first test since I was in third grade that I aced. I got 100. I got an A+. I got 7 questions so right, and Dr. Bohan's sitting there, and he said, you know, your suitcase is packed, and we're ready to send you to Farley. I said, oh, my God. And he explained what Farley was, up in Williamsburg. You'll be gone for 45 days because you're that sick. Your bag's packed. You'll have no cell phone. Your part-time job at Smithfield, you can't do that. You need to get cleaned up. By the end of the interview with Dr. Bohan, he said, I don't know what it is. Some of your wife's situation has something to do with this. I'm going to send you to Virginia Beach Psychiatric Center, and you're going to go to the outpatient program. So there I went. So Dr. Bohan was on staff. I went there, and like I did at my first meeting, I took a look at that collection of humanity at Virginia Beach Psych. And I said, this can't be for Jim. These people are not like me. These people are absolutely the dregs of the earth and everything like that. And so I did all my paperwork, went upstairs with the same attitude. And Mary Gorman, who ran that program, some of you may know her, and she goes by her full name. From the minute she laid eyes on me, she didn't like me. I was everything that she didn't like. The corporate America Jim actually wore a business suit, a tie, shine shoes, and walked into Virginia Beach Psych in a business suit. Boy, did she get pissed off. She went delirious. So I go to Virginia Beach Psych, wore the suit the second day. The second day's over, and Mary says, here's some news for you, pal. I know you don't own blue jeans because you're too uppity. I know that you don't wear gym shoes except to play sports. But if you ever come back in this psychiatric center in a business suit, you'll never see the light of day. I promise you that. And I have the power to do that. And when you leave here today, you will come back here an hour earlier than everybody. I want you here at 6 o'clock. I'll be here. I want you to have a sponsor. I want to know his home group. I want his address and I want his phone number. And if you don't do that, that suitcase that's sitting in the back of my office here will be shipped to Farley. And I don't know when you're going to get out of Farley. And I have the power to do that. And Dr. Bohan has the power to do that. That scared the living crap out of me. That I was going to be away and sent away. And I'd have to explain that to my friends and family. Best thing that ever happened to me. So I go to rehab. Sarah arranged everything. I didn't have to do anything. So I met my sponsor on Sunday at the last possible minute before he left, because I had a deadline of Monday morning at 6 to have a sponsor or I'm going to rehab in Williamsburg. So God starts to work for this alcoholic in amazing ways. God was still not present in my life except for you show up to temple and go through the high holidays. So I start the program. Still have the addiction physician, and I go to start the step work with Rick, who, by the way, is still my sponsor, and I love him more than anybody else in the world. So he starts to work with me. Rehab was, I could tell stories about that, as most people can if they've ever been to rehab. It was one flew over the cuckoo's nest times 10. It was the craziest place I've ever been in my life, and I've been in some crazy places. So we start to work the program, and Rick is the type of sponsor who, working the steps, is reads every frigging word of every frigging sentence in the big book and the 12 and 12. It took me almost 5 years to complete the 12-step program. Some of that was my kind of malaise at different times. But most of it was because Rick would not change the way that he was taught by Arthur. And for those of you who know Arthur, Arthur is Arthur. And Rick is Rick. And I don't have any chance. So about the second, third month, I don't know what time. I got a few more minutes.
You're doing good. Keep going. Okay. It's 8:40, you're good.
Okay. So I start the program and I did what most people in the program do. When I went to a meeting, I sat in the farthest corner I could find. I didn't want to see anybody. Everybody in the room looked like they did in rehab. There's a collection of humanity in these rooms that I still, to that day, I just didn't believe that I was the same. It has been explained to me that you are the same. You're an alcoholic. Get over it. But I still couldn't get that grasp of how I blend in with you all. Because you don't know how great I am, still was running around in my head. I had been destroyed by alcohol, had wreaked carnage over family after family after family member, drove a car off the highway. I had done all these things and it still didn't register with me that I was one of you. So, worked the program, and And I still am carrying, probably the biggest guilt I've got is the automobile accident. And about 3 months into the program, I'm sitting there in Magnolia Brown Bag one Tuesday night. I'm ready to explode. And God reached down and told me to share and recount the entire episode in front of people I hardly knew. I cried probably throughout the entire show. I still cry a lot. It's good for me. So I got done, meeting's over, and a guy who unfortunately has passed away, Dale Engelhart, comes up to me. And he said, Jim, I listened to your share. He said, I'd really like to have coffee with you. I didn't understand the concept of, oh, I'd really like to have coffee with you. So we picked out a day, and I went over to some cafe that he in his neighborhood in Portsmouth and sat down, and he said, let me tell you my story. So he tells me his story and stuff like that, and he gets to the point, and he says, in your share that you said that you drove off the road, Sarah went out the top of the car. He recounted it almost word for word. He said, I have a similar circumstance. I was in the Navy, blackout drunk, didn't know where the hell I was, and completely ran over two sailors on the way back to the shipyard. Killed them instantly. And didn't know I killed them. I kept on driving. I'm thinking to myself, it doesn't make me feel better, but it does. This guy who I don't know very well has the strength and the courage and the love to share that with me. And I was never the same after that. I then sought help about it. People in the rooms embraced me. They didn't quite understand what was going on in my life, but they understood that I was an alcoholic and I needed help and I needed love. I needed a hug. I needed some justification because I was still a little bit lost. So God started to work in amazing ways. It wasn't very long after that that I went to Rick and I said, restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't put the pieces together about what you people were talking about, this God thing. It was driving me nuts. And I started to associate it in my ego, in my craziness, in my world of Jim's the best, that I am not the same as these people, these Bible-thumping Baptists, the people who go to Catholic Church, and all these religions that have nothing to do with Judaism. And Rick said, stop right there. You got your head up your rear end. Everybody in these rooms has their God. And it's about time that you got yours. And for some reason, God made those words stick. I understood it. So I went on and started to pray, started to meditate, started to read literature, started to journal, started to even call alcoholics. Went to the 90-90 program, did everything that we're supposed to do and we're told to do. And miraculously, I started to find my way. And when he introduced me to the inventory sheet, which was well beyond because I wasn't even close to the 11th step, he said, I don't care where you're on the program, you're going to start doing this and I'm going to see it. He said, you do it, check us off every night. Some from week to week, I'll say, can I see your inventory sheet and we'll talk about it. The first time I did an inventory sheet and showed it to him, at the top of mine is liabilities, and at the bottom is assets. I had not checked an asset in 3 weeks. Rick's too nice to say, what the hell is this? But he said, what the hell is this? And I said, I don't have any assets. I was still down. I was still out. He said, let me tell you something about this program. One day, there's two things going to happen. This is the first time I went over across the table at him. First thing is you're going to thank God that you're married to a paraplegic, which really pissed me off. And the second thing is one day assets are going to outnumber the liabilities. And I said, well, you're crazy. He said, well, I may be crazy, but as long as I'm your sponsor, this is the way we're going to do this. So all that came to pass, and I started working on the program. As I said, it took me about 4 years to get myself together, to do what he asked me to do everything you people told me to do. And let me end with this. This will take a few minutes. I cannot describe for you how grateful I am. I lived 63 years before I walked into this program. That's craziness. And it all was because I was so much better than you people. I didn't need any help. I didn't want any help. I wasn't going to ask for help, and I wasn't going to accept it if you gave it to me. So my life changed to, it flipped from my will to thy will. That's the first thing that clicked with me. The second thing is that you all promised me in the meetings that I first went to, and for years and years, you kept reading this thing called the promises. And I kept looking around the room at you poor souls. And I said, if these people can be this happy, this joyous, and this free, there must be something to this thing called the promises. Today, if you notice me at a meeting when you read the promises, I bow my head. I think it's a prayer. And it's something that's kept me together for a lot of years. And it actually gave me hope that I, some poor wretch like me, can come out of the doldrums that I was. Working the program, taking action, being accountable, wasn't part of my DNA. I had to get over being a sweeper. I had to get over wishing it would go away. I had to get over the fact that I can sell you anything I want, to include my sponsor, and he'll buy it. Doesn't work in this program. The bullshit barometer in this program, excuse the expression, is as finely tuned as anything I've ever seen in my entire life. And some days I really feel bad for normal people, because they go on in their own delirium like I did for years, and they're not privy to the bullshit barometer that I am accustomed to. When somebody asked me, I now understand this, somebody asked me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, Jim, how are you? They're not asking me how my day is. They're not asking me how my family is. They want to know what I'm doing in my program. I understand that, and I appreciate that, and I respect that, and I thank you for that. I have a daily reprieve. I don't think about alcohol very much. It's one of the miracles of the program that you all are aware of. But I must do my daily program. I must do it when I want, when I need to do it. Not feeling like I want to do it is not an excuse. I have got to work my program. And I've got to work my program in its entirety. Rick taught me how to listen. I would take everybody's inventory when they share it. If I didn't like the way you looked, or you weren't like me, whatever the hell that is, I would tune it out. I wouldn't listen clearly. I now am obsessive about watching people eyeball to eyeball, listening to them share, and I don't care if it's the same share I've heard 20 times. Because somewhere out of that share is going to give me another brick in my foundation on the road to happy, joyous, and free. So I intently look at you in the eyeball, which I never could do for a long period of time, when you're sharing. I understand today this is for this alcoholic. Sobriety is wonderful. Not taking a drink is wonderful. The real golden nugget of this program is the way of life. I'll be 77 next month. And I will tell you that the last 13 years and some odd months have been the best thing I've ever imagined. It's because of this program. It's because of you people. It's because of the hundreds of people that I've met in this program. So every once in a while, when Jimmy's a bad boy, my sponsor makes me do gratitude lists. That really yanks me. I hate doing gratitude lists. And he checks my homework. It's unbelievable. Don't you know who I am? Don't you know what I've done? He doesn't care. He wants to see my gratitude list. He also checks my inventory sheet still, as I said. And the other gifts from the way of life from AA for this alcoholic, I have now become a responsible and dependable husband, father, friend, and grandfather. I've got 4 grandchildren. They're the cutest little crappers you've ever seen in your entire life. And they call Papa Pig, or they call me Pops, and they pick up their phones. even at the age of 4 or 5, 6 or 7, and we do FaceTime. I never would have had that if I would have kept on drinking. The other thing is that I talk about my inventory sheet. Today, when I do my inventory, and it's an honest appraisal, my assets outnumber my liabilities. I'm not trying to say I'm better than most everybody, but the way of life that I've been taught prompts me to do the next right thing. Prompts me to pick up the phone and call somebody when I hate the phone. I still can't stand it. Don't like to call anybody. I am now prompted by God to send notes for no reason to somebody. The only motive I have right now is to be kind, because everybody's been so kind to me. Happiness and serenity are directly proportionate to my work in the program. All those years of making sales presentations and getting people to buy what I want them to buy doesn't work in this program. I have to be honest to a fault. I have to work my program. I can't wish it. I don't have anything better to do. I don't have anything more important to do than to work my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so every morning, if you want to go by 8057 Clubhouse Drive in Suffolk, you'll see some alcoholic on the back deck. 6 o'clock in the morning. It can be raining, snowing, sleeting, hailing, 100 degrees, I don't care, I'm out there. Talking with my best friend now, God, and starting to get it started on the day. Sometimes, from time to time, I have to do the man in the mirror. I'll go to my grave hating that, because sometimes I really don't like what I'm looking at. But through the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, I start to look at that man in the mirror, and I'm pretty comfortable with him today. I now know and understand that asking for help is one thing, accepting help is the bigger idea. And I do both. From being just solitary, I can do it all, I now ask for and accept help. I'm a big proponent of service to others inside and outside the program, like you all are. Sponsorship to me, I think I've had 7 sponsees. I still have 2 that are still sticking to it. I lost a sponsee to the disease of cirrhosis of the liver or alcoholism, and I miss Ronnie more than anything. But he just couldn't make it. He was so sick when I got him, and he just couldn't last. He taught me more about bravery than anybody except my wife. Bravery and courage. The unconditional love and help from the fellowship, all of you in this room. I started coming to this meeting last week. I may not be here every week, but I'm going to start coming. Because I meet new people. The sobriety in this room means a lot to me. You, for the, you know, everybody that was here last week remembers me. And that's of great comfort to this alcoholic. I need to be hugged. And I am not uneasy with that statement. I need a hug. I need somebody to tell me, Jim, you're okay. I'm really happy that you're working the program the way you are. At 77, I need that reinforcement. And so I'll close in this with one thing. Just because I'm sober, and this goes for everybody in this program, doesn't mean that life doesn't throw you some curveballs. Well, Sarah and I were doing really good with paraplegia. We had got a new wife. She was doing wonderful things from a wheelchair. As you can see by the size of me, she was a great cook. She could cook like somebody else. She had a PhD in shopping, and she loved her friends. She loved her family. And don't ever use the word step when you call her a stepmother. She will absolutely come out of that chair at you. Sarah died five weeks ago. Wasn't of anything except she got, her wires got crossed with dementia. And I'm not too sure what to do. And I'm not ashamed of saying that. I've never had a point in time, and the only thing that's keeping me together is the fellowship. And I'll end with this. I have never had a time of life where I really had nothing to do. I was always a caregiver. I was always going out of the house on Monday and coming home on Friday, drunk on my rear end most of the time, making a hell of a lot of money, trying to provide for my family and being better than my dad. So the day I go home, it's quiet. Sarah's not there. Just me and the cat. The fellowship has kept me together. The day after she died, five people from the fellowship called me. They had heard through somewhere that Sarah had passed. 3 days after she died, I go to a meeting. I walked in the room with Magnolia Brown Bag. I was hugged, told me I was loved. Most everybody knew by that time that Sarah had passed away, and all they had was open arms and an open heart. You can't get that anywhere in the world. You can't manufacture this model here. And for the last 5 weeks, I have found strength in these rooms. I couldn't get to a lot of meetings when Sarah was alive. I now go to 3 face-to-face. I work with my sponsees twice a week. I'm in it. I'm in it like I've never been in it before. And I will not call it a crutch. I need this program like oxygen, because you give me what I need. And I thank you for it. I love you all.
Jim, thank you so much.